Hi, I'm Susie Larson. Here's the podcast from Susie Larson Live. Enjoy the conversation. It's only just a matter of... You're listening to a special best of edition of Susie Larson Live. Hello, welcome to Susie Larson Live. So glad to have you listening today. I'm Susie Larson, and this is a special edition where I'm highlighting some of my favorite guests from this year so far. This week during our live show, we are in the midst of our winter fundraiser. If you'd like to join us and support Faith Radio financially, you can give at myfaithradio.com or call 877-933-2484. Your financial support makes shows like mine possible. So thank you so very much. So over the next hour, you'll hear parts of some of our best conversations from 2020 so far. For example, I always love it when I get to talk to Dr. Kurt Thompson. His book is titled The Soul of Shame, Retelling the Stories We Believe About Ourselves. But first, I want you to hear from Rebecca Lyons. Her book is Rhythms for a Life Planner and Journal, 90 Days to Peace and Purpose. Rebecca Lyons is a national speaker, host of Rhythms for Life podcast, best-selling author of Rhythms of Renewal. She's an old soul with a contemporary, honest voice. She reveals her own battles to overcome anxiety and depression and invites others to boldly pursue their God-given purpose. Alongside her husband, Gabe, Rebecca raises four children, two with Down syndrome, and I told her before the show she should have been on long ago, but it's so good to have you today, Rebecca. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Looking forward to the conversation. We love to start every day talking scripture. Wondering if there's a passage you've just been pondering these days as you spend time with God.
Yes, 2 Timothy 1:7 is a famous one for a lot of people I know, but it is one that's top of mind these days in particular, which is, hey, Rebecca, I've not given you a spirit of fear, but power, love, and a sound mind. And I grew up learning the King James Version, and I love the way it languages sound mind. It means there's a sound groundedness in our mind. There's a calm, a peace that we really do need as we navigate the waters that we're in right now.
Beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. Well, if you don't mind, give us a little backstory on your journey, your battle with anxiety and fear, and how God met you there.
Yes. So for me, it really began about a decade ago. My husband, Gabe, and I had moved to New York City, like the heart of Manhattan, from the suburbs in the South. And we had three children at the time that were 9, 7, and almost 5. And I remember joking with friends, it's like you're going off to college, except with kids. And turns out that's not a thing, actually. we were just resetting. It was this midlife reset. We were going there because we felt this deep conviction to just be a part of our faith intersecting with culture, being on the front lines of culture. We were meeting a lot of people in arts, media, government, policy, education that loved God, but often felt isolated and alone in their vocational career. And so we wanted to serve those people, and a lot of them came through New York City often as a hub of enterprise, and we just wanted to be present there as salt and light. And so as a result, we sold most of what we had, and we moved our minivan and our two toy poodles all the way to the heart of Manhattan. And I remember my youngest daughter was starting kindergarten, so I had kind of ended that 10-year run of diapers and Cheerios and poop, you know, being home full-time, rolling up my sleeves, just serving in that capacity. My oldest son, who was 9 at the time, had a Down syndrome diagnosis, so that even had, you know, changed the trajectory of my life when he was born 9 years earlier when I was 26. So this time in New York was almost a time of recovering, like, who is Rebecca before children or outside of them being home? What do I do with these 6, 7, 8 hours a day that I now have kind of to look in the mirror and going, what are you doing with, what does calling and vocation look like in this new moment? And so I was taking different classes downtown. I had a background in design and, you know, I just loved that. So I was taking classes downtown, but turns out 4 months into my time into New York City, I had my first panic attack on a flight from Atlanta back to LaGuardia. It was almost midnight and it was a tumultuous, horrible turbulence. And I just remember something rose in me from the soles of my feet to the top of my head. And I was consumed and gripped by a fear of being trapped. And it was not even about the plane crashing. It was about when it finally landed, I would be trapped in the back of the plane. And so it was kind of crazily rooted in claustrophobia, but it was something I'd never known, and I had no idea what to do with it. So while everyone's doubling down and buckling their seatbelts, I, on the other hand, am, you know, barreling, like, you know, St. Elmo's fire, running to the front of the plane. And the sweet flight attendant, who's like, you know, on her little jump seat, is like, no. And I'm like, yes. And I'm just running. And I'm like, move. And I was like, son, one of us was going to win. And I had momentum. Mm. And I remember collapsing in the galley at the front of the plane. Mm. And I just kept saying, panic, panic, panic. And that what began that day while everyone exited the plane continued for the next 18 months on planes, trains, elevators, subways, and crowds. We had, if you've been to New York City, you know it's impossible to avoid those things. And so God had allowed me to enter a spiral in some ways of getting to the end of myself to really help me rebuild a life.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, I've heard so many stories, Rebecca, of if high-profile leaders and people hidden in the shadows who've gone through the same thing. And how did God meet you? When did you start to notice a turnaround? When did you? Because you know, it's one thing to experience that and feel that gripping, you know, sense, as you said, that things are closing in. It's another thing to be bracing for impact because you know it's already happened once or twice or 20 times. So to brace for impact in case it happens again, you start to live in the fight flight. I mean, how did you navigate, before I ask you how God met you, how did you and Gabe navigate those incredible months?
Right. Well, it's true. The muscle memory of the amygdala that starts to fire, fight, flight, or freeze. I was definitely a fighter and a flighter. I didn't freeze. I almost just got so aggressive with trying to escape. So what began on that flight, then on an, like, let's say, for example, 2 weeks later on a subway, I just had to go two stops underground to see my daughter do a production at her school. She had a solo. And so I'm thinking, okay, we can do this. This is not a plane crashing in the sky. We're just going downstairs, we're getting on the subway. Well, what happens was this hits in the month of December where all the tourists are coming and they have all their bags. Somehow people think they're only supposed to buy for Christmas while they're in New York City.
Right.
So they get on the subway with multiple bags, and then right as the doors are closing, 20 more people hop on, and I'm all of a sudden going, no, 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 this is far too crowded. I can't breathe. And I'm literally the woman who puts her coffee on the ground and I'm trying to claw the doors back open right before we take off. And it's just because something comes over me that says, if you don't get out right now, you will die. It's this lie of that fight or flight that says, if you don't escape, you won't survive. I can't even explain the closing in, but that's really how claustrophobia works. It's this metaphor and a literal sense of feeling trapped and powerless to the fear or the torment, quite frankly, that's coming over you. So that happened then, and it would happen on an elevator. I would, you know, we had Bloomingdale's around the corner, and the kids section where the shoe department was on the ninth floor. And so from our apartment, I could walk to it, and I started to like watch the galley of doors. There's like a line of 10 elevators. And I would wait to see if there was one where there were just like three people, because I wouldn't hop on alone, but I couldn't hop on one with nine people or 10 people because that would be too crowded. So if more people came on, I would jump back off. I mean, it literally looked insane. And finally, I would go find the stairwell and I would just go the nine flights because I just was like, I can't do this. And so that was just a glimpse of what normal became. I would walk across Central Park and not even take the subway anymore. I got really fit that year because I'm always just, I would rather not put myself in that situation because I was less afraid in reality of the being trapped, but more afraid of my body in response to the feeling of this kind of illusionary doom, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
And so I was more afraid of me than I was of the circumstance itself. And so I started just shrinking back and avoiding all kinds of things.
Well, because it feels like an involuntary response, you know? I mean, you could be having a great day, and all of a sudden you start to feel things rise up, and the panic sets in. It's not like you turned on a switch and think, you know, this is going to be scary, so I'm going to panic, you know? I mean, there is an involuntariness to it, isn't there?
Right. And every emotion is triggered by a memory, the more I know now that I've studied the brain for a decade. So when you start to feel something, it's partly because your brain is processing so fast, it's actually the emotion is triggered by the memory of last time something similar to this happened, you reacted this way. And so that emotion is already starting before, preemptively, before even you are connecting the dots that this is a memory of what you did before. That's why people have a muscle memory of the things that are fearful, because every time they face those in the past, it made them afraid. And so now you're almost preemptively making that circumstance fearful even before it ever is, because all the memories are attached to that same emotion of fear.
Yeah, they say nerves that fire together wire together. So you've got the experience, you've got the emotional response, the two become one, and anything reminiscent of that triggers. And I think, again, it's so common. I so appreciate your honesty about it. We're going to pause here. When we come back, then to the question, how God met you, how you navigated through it, and how you found breakthrough. I know some are listening today, sitting at the edge of their seat going, you're writing my story, you're telling my story. Talking to best-selling author Rebecca Lyons, and she released today this hardcover, big, heavy, I love it. It's this hardcover planner and journal, Rhythms for Life, 90 Days to Peace and Purpose. Day by day, you're challenged on your inputs, your outputs, your rest, how you get restored, how you connect with others, how you create. It's wonderful. You're going to love it. We've got 5 copies to give away. You can text the word book if you want in on the drawing, 877-933-2484, and we will be back in a minute. You're listening to a special best of edition of Suzy Larson Live.
Be still, oh, restless.
Thanks so much for tuning into Suzy Larson Live. You know, I just want to let that song play out. Sometimes you just got to breathe. You got to exhale. You got to remember who God is. Remember who you are to him. I'm talking to best-selling author Rebecca Lyons today, celebrating the release of her big, heavy, I love it, hardcover journal. It's a planner and journal, Rhythms for Life, 90 Days to Peace and Purpose. We'll get to what's in this journal, but I want you to know we've got 5 copies to give away. To me, it's this invitation to exhale. It's an invitation to care for your soul, to pay attention to your inputs and outputs. As I said, we've got 5 copies to give away. Text the word book if you want in on the drawing, 877-933-2484. So Rebecca, prior to the break, you were talking, giving us your backstory on your battle with anxiety, with panic attacks, and cannot even thank you enough for your raw honesty around that. So my question now is, you know, 18 months is a long time, especially living in New York where you can't avoid crowds and pressed circumstances. How did you break through? How did God meet you?
I'm glad you asked. It was quite an up and down struggle. There was a lot of crying out, a lot of release, a lot of surrender, also a lot of shrinking back and avoiding things. I do remember what began as rooted in claustrophobia would then slowly over time morph into waking from dreams in a panic attack in my bed, or walking the streets of New York City and being on a playground and barely being able to take a deep breath. So it almost evolved even not just entrapped in tight spaces, but more of a smothering, like a shallow breathing, which again, now that I know the brain, that is the fight or flight response that's actually overwhelmed. And you, breath is the first to go. It's so interesting that the breath of God that gives us life is the first thing that starts to feel like you can't get a deep breath. So a lot of times panic attacks will go after the root of life, whether it's your heart. Some people feel like they're having a heart attack. And some people are feeling like they're being smothered, like they can't actually get a deep breath. And so for me, it was very attached to shallow breathing, and I was just trying so hard to fill my lungs. And so I remember September 20th of 2011, in particular, I wrote the date down. I was in a a Bible study with four women who had moved to the city. We called it a Bible study. It was definitely a support group with some scripture thrown in. We were all like, can we keep going? Because a lot of us had moved from other cities, and just the pace and the unknown and a lot of just the intensity, we were all, it was a very steep learning curve for a lot of us. And I do remember them saying, how's the panic? And I said, it's fine. But I didn't like to talk about it. At this point, it was just, I felt shameful, honestly, that I just couldn't get victory in this area, because God and I had walked together for a long time. And yet, for whatever reason, this spiral just continued. And so all this to say, I do remember them praying for me that day. And that night, in the middle of the night, around 3 a.m, I woke up in the middle of the night from a dream, and I just felt complete panic. And it was just the middle of a panic attack. And my husband woke with me, and I couldn't speak. I just, you know, gripped his arm, and he knew the drill. He just began to pray. And as he's in the middle of praying for me, I believe that God just gave me my voice. And out of nowhere, I just, in the dark of the room, I just raised my left hand and I said, rescue me, deliver me. I cannot do this without you. And in that particular moment, I don't know why it didn't happen prior or why it happened the way it did, but my body just broke in the bed, and I collapsed, and all was still. Like, all the shaking, all the panic, all the anxiousness, all the inability to breathe just stopped. And it was like a complete calm, and nothing could even move but my eyes, you know, back and forth in the dark. And it was this stillness and peace, like total and complete peace, that I'd never experienced before without having to exit the situation for the panic to subside. And I just remember the next day leaving my apartment, kind of like tiptoeing out the door, going like, did it take? Like, I wouldn't have called it healing at the time. It was almost just this encounter of peace. And I started to walk out of my apartment the next day, and I started to see the city in living color. It was like something had lifted, like almost a cloud of doom had lifted off of me. A fear had been lifted off of me. And I started to just notice people just like me, 1 in 4 on medication for some sort of anxiety or depression, just a whole population of people gripped in fear. And that's when I kind of got that life verse reminder. Hey, Rebecca, remember, I haven't given you a spirit of fear. I've given you power, love, and a sound mind. And anxiety had become my fancy word for fear. I just walked in it. I lived in it. I carried it. And so I said, I started to go, God, if this is not something that you have given me, but you've called me into power and sound mind and peace. Goodness gracious, Jesus is our peace. He's the Prince of Peace, and we come under that covering of peace. Then show me how to walk this out. And that's when I started meeting with people one by one over coffee, or just started teaching in these smaller groups, just like my experience. And I did not have another panic attack for 7 years. It was gone. And so that was the rescue of God. I very much liken it to Psalm 18, just to show me his rescue. I had never known the rescue of God like that in the 30 years I call myself a Christian. I accepted Christ at 5, but it was partly because I didn't want to burn. I didn't really know what I was being saved from. But I did know that Jesus was real, and I knew that the story of the gospel was true, and I wanted a relationship with him, and that was enough for my 5-year-old self. But my 35-year-old self said, oh, this is the power of the resurrection right here, and this is what I want to walk in, and I want to learn again what it looks like to grow in faith in this way.
Wow, Rebecca, what a story. I'm sitting at the edge of my seat, and I'm trying to remind myself to breathe as I'm listening to you. And you said for 7 years, and then can you tell us what happened then, if you don't mind?
Sure. I feel like this is like airing all my laundry, but wow. I have written about it, so I guess it's okay. Gabe always jokes that I'm a chronic oversharer, and he always has to edit my book to make sure that he approves of everything I put in. And then eventually he just succumbs to it and goes, okay, it's fine. You just go ahead and say it.
You're hilarious. I love it. I love it. I love you. I love you. So keep going.
Okay. So what happens after that is I begin to write about it. And I kind of write the crash and burn story in my first book, Free Fall to Fly. And then I start teaching about it. And the great irony of all this is that I wrote three books, like Free Fall to Fly and then You Are Free, which is all about freedom, about that rescue moment. And if Jesus is who he says he is, why don't we live a life of abundance, for crying out loud? Why are we all enslaved? And so it was really just kind of like, let's get to the heart of the matter. Is this real? You know, is this actually transformational? And if it's not, why not? So I just kept writing on those things and teaching. And the hilarity is that God would put me on a plane every Friday night to travel the country to teach about the rescue of God in the same place that gave me my first panic attack. So I just think that it's so kind of God to, you know, the old place of panic became a sanctuary in the sky. Of course, there were still temptations if I got on a plane that was unexpectedly small, or there was a long delay and there was a snow delay and we had to de-ice 5 times. In fact, there's one story I tell where I'm going to teach a message on freedom in Atlanta and we can't get off the runway in New York. And the girl next to me is having a panic attack because we've been de-icing for 6 hours. And I'm like, don't worry, I've done this before. It's going to be okay.
Wow.
You know, like, part of this idea of like our pain becomes purpose. We are able to use the strongholds in our life in prior seasons to help bring freedom for other people too, because the power of testimony in Revelation 12:11, he says the enemy is bound by two things. It's Christ's blood and your story, your testimony of God at work in your life. And so I do believe that a lot of times we walk through hard things. God allows those things to happen so that we can be a living testimony of God's power and anointing. Not that we would ask for those things or really want that story, but he always makes it for good. He always makes it for good. Nothing is wasted. And so that's what the next several years look like. And then when I was launching and writing into my third book, that's when this panic attack happened. And that's why I begin the book that way. I was in the season of writing. And what I learned is that I'd put a lot of practices in place for safeguards for health, but I was getting really busy and saying yes to a lot of wonderful things and did not have enough margin and capacity in my life. And I honestly think we can get ahead of the pace that God's prepared for us. Psalm 139 very clearly says that he knit us in our mother's womb and our works were wonderful and our frame was not hidden from him. We were made in a secret place. It says his eyes saw our unformed body and all our days were written and planned before one of them began. So God has a plan and a destiny for our lives, and he knits us with birthright gifts to use to get there, but we can outrun the pace that he's prepared for mm-hmm. us. And mm-hmm. I found that I was doing that. I found that I was like, hey, God, are we good? Okay, good. I'm going, you know, and I wasn't resting and restoring enough. I was doing the output rhythms, those last two of connect and create, but at the rest and restore were on such a depletion that by the time I was in this venue for a retreat we were hosting, my phone dies. We're in a 100-year-old building. Nobody's coming back for 2 hours because we had a break in the afternoon. I go to the bathroom in this tiny stall, and it was like a cement walls, 12 inches thick, and literally the doorknob breaks of this 100-year-old home. And
That whole conversation was amazing. That was Rebecca Lyons, and again, we talked about her journal planner. It's called Rhythms for Life Planner and Journal, 90 Days to Peace and Purpose. Coming up next now, you'll get to hear a portion of my conversation with Dr. Kurt Thompson. We talked a little bit about his book, The Soul of Shame, retelling the stories we believe about ourselves. And we will be back in a moment. You're listening to a special best of edition of Suzy Larson Live. Coming up next now, you'll get to hear a portion of my conversation with Dr. Kurt Thompson. We talked a little bit about his book, The Soul of Shame, retelling the stories we believe about ourselves. Cry I love that song. Thanks so much for tuning into Susie Larson Live, talking to Dr. Kurt Thompson, just really having an interesting conversation about navigating and really paralleling our journeys in some way. You know, when the Israelites were exiled to Babylon, and in part because of their unbelief, their disregard of God, it was really a consequence of forgetting who he was. But in this new place, God said, seek the prosperity of your city, plant gardens, have babies, flourish here, and create here. And Anne Graham Lotz was on about a month ago, and she said, you know, we can shake our fist basically at the state of the nation, but the state of the nation is a direct result of the state of the church. And this is a wake-up call for the church to be mindful of the lost and the hurting and the broken. And as we talk about this idea of just of creating, and, you know, we're doing this great giveaway, Kurt, I just got to tell you this real quick, that we're just mobilizing as many people as possible to just go out and do random acts of kindness. And we're going to talk about it in a couple of weeks. But, you know, people could bake cookies and just walk across the street and give them to a neighbor, right? And that's creating something, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that we probably have not been as effective as we could be or as rigorous as we could be in our primary teaching of spiritual formation in and around this notion of creation, this notion that, like, you know, as I write about in my book that's coming out here within the next year, you don't have to teach a toddler or a 3 or 4 year old to make things. They just go do it. And then they bring you this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And they anticipate that when they do, that you're gonna think it's wonderful and that you're gonna put it on the refrigerator, or that they are just making things all the time. And they do so with great joy. And the way that they do it generates connection in relationship. And that relationship only serves to enhance even more so their desire and hunger to go on and create. And this, we would suggest, is what it looks like for us to be children of God, that we're intended to go and create. But we find that shame starts to enter into this picture very early on in our process, just in the same way that it did in the creation narrative in Genesis chapter 3. And as such, our shame, as it has taken up residence in our primary stories, sometimes then makes it difficult for us to even imagine how to create. And so we need help with this. We need help generating ideas. So you've just said, hey, what would it be like if you were just to bake some cookies? And, you know, there may be maybe many of your listeners, like some of your listeners who haven't cooked anything. Like, well, that just goes in one ear and out the other, because, like, I don't do that. And I would say, well, wait a minute, really? Like, Susie has just mentioned this. What if you would try it? What if you would say, like, look, okay, I'm going to try. Well, I'm going to find a cookie recipe, and I'm going to bake it for my neighbor, and I'm just going to go do that, and I'm going to offer that. I'm going to put that creative act out into the world and see what happens. And this is what, and of course, these are, remember, creative acts, truly creative acts, are always ultimately going to be acts of great vulnerability, right? When an artist, like, creates, at some point, if they're really serious about their work, they're going to put it on public display. And that means that they're going to have to take the risk that there are going to be people who are not going to like it. There are going to be critics who say, this is awful. They're going to have to take risks. If I'm going to, you know, put my piece of music out there, if I'm going to put my cake that I just baked out there for you to try, like, I'm going to want to try that. And when we do these creative acts, they're greatly vulnerable acts. And we would say, of course, because this is what it was like for God to make us. It was an act of great vulnerability for God to make humans, to make the world, because at some point he knows the Good Friday is coming. And if I'm Jesus and the Holy Trinity are thinking, like, we're going to consider making humankind, and I'm Jesus, I'm thinking, like, I think we need to think about this a little longer before we do this. You know, because, like, he sees where this is going to go. And they do it anyway.
Not everybody would accept, reject even. Right.
And this notion of God demonstrating, proving his willingness to be all in with us, in not just in making us, but all in with us in our worst nightmares, is what Good Friday in part is all about. It is God saying, there's no place you all can go or have been that I'm not willing to join you in. And there we have Jesus, stripped naked, beaten, crucified. The worst thing the humans have ever done to any other human in terms of their humiliating execution of another human, all at the hand of what at the time was the most sophisticated political and religious systems on the planet. They converge to kill an innocent man, and this is God saying, yeah, this is what it means to create. Years ago, 1993, in the middle of Sarajevo, there was a cellist who, for 21 days, many of our listeners may be able to recall this, that this, the Balkan Civil War that broke out, and Vedran Smailovic is his name, and for 21 straight days, he took his cello out into the middle of a bomb crater and played for the 21 victims who were killed in a bread line by a mortar attack. And he's playing in the middle of this bombed out city in the face of sniper fire, in the face of mortar rounds that could come. 21 days in a row he played. And it didn't stop the shelling, but it got the world's attention. And I want to say to our listeners, but this is what we do as believers. We pick up our cellos and we go to the bomb craters and we play. Because it is beauty, even in the most unexpected places, that God is going to draw forth. It is beauty that he will use to save the world, and beauty that comes in the most unexpected ways. If we were to consider Good Friday on our terms, we wouldn't even remember it. That's if true. Not for Easter, we would remember it. The Romans themselves did not like to talk about crucifixion, even though they desperately needed it in order to contain their slave populations. They wouldn't talk about it. It was too heinous. It was too embarrassing. How is it that something like that is the very thing that we look at as saving the essence of who we are? Because we see it through the lens of Good Friday, because God sees the bomb craters and he says, that's where I'm going. And I'm going not just to hunker down, I'm going to create beauty that no one could imagine coming from such awful places. If you're listening and your marriage is the bomb crater, your substance abusing child is the bomb crater, your fear about the world is the bomb crater, your medical health, I want us to hear that it is God's intention for beauty to emerge from that very place. And I also want us to hear that we are called to be vessels of bringing that beauty into the very bomb craters of other people's lives, not least of which being those people with whom we find that we have great difference. We see all the fracture lines around us. We see all the people with whom we believe we disagree, and it is with those folks who have real names and real faces and who have real addresses to whom God says, I want you to make that family a dozen cookies for Christmas. And I know you've never made cookies because you're a middle-aged white dude, and I want you to make them and take them. And I want you to see yourself as an agent of beauty that you're not only creating, but that you are becoming in the process. And I'm not going to allow evil gates or shame to stand against it. But we cannot do this by ourselves. We do this in community, and we do this with courage, and we do it with fear and trembling.
This is where live radio is tricky for me. You know, as you're talking, I'm remembering when I was a young mom and I'd been on bed rest for 6 months with our third pregnancy, which already confronted so much of my own insecurity and identity issues, and overlapped with that, ended up with Lyme disease. I got bit during the pregnancy, and I was back in bed, and I had three little boys, and I'd used up all my friend favors, and God seemed so silent, and I was in this, our secondhand king-size bed that dipped down in the middle. We couldn't afford anything more. And I had an IV, the giant IV bag hooked up to our little plant hanger in our bedroom. And our oldest friends came with a guitar, and that was our creator, you know, that bad friend. And they worshiped and they sang. And I said, I can't do this. I can't be a mom to three kids with a neuro. I can't. And they said, you can, and you will. And they started to sing, and I'll never forget it. And they took intention, you know. And I just think we minimize our gift, but. Today, I still cry about it when I think about it, you know?
Yeah, and I think, you know, we are, Susie, so, we are so utilitarian. We are a people who want to see the problem and fix it. You know, we've recently had a significant, person in our immediate family who's had a significant mental health crisis, and here I am, a psychiatrist, and you know, I can't fix it, and all I know that I can do is be present and be curious, and the thing is, we so want to fix things that we don't imagine that just our very presence in and of itself communicates beauty and goodness merely by the way that we attune and are attentive to others, merely by not leaving the room when the other is sure that we're going to go. And I think of that whole notion that, you know, we just want to know what is the problem and how can I fix this. And the whole idea that we could worship, that we, like, I think about your story, and the whole idea that we could play music, that we could worship, and that introduction of beauty into the moment could somehow change the moment. We don't think, like, that's not giving us, that's not solving my problem. That's not. And yet, who of us humans would ever imagine that crucifixion was the way to glory? Who would ever imagine that Good Friday was God at work? Yes, fixing our problem as humans, but doing so because he's on the way to making something new. And that is what he's paying attention to. And that is what he's calling us to do as well.
Amen. We're going to pause here. When we come back, I want to talk about how being known helps us persevere, and how perseverance and endurance, I think they're two different things, but I'd love your take on that as well. Talking to Dr. Kurt Thompson, just always so honored to get him on the show. And I think we've got a few copies of his book to give away. Sorry, I'm such a sap. You guys are so sweet to me. I'm a sap. What can I say? I cry easily. But the title of Dr. Kurt's book, this one, The Soul of Shame, Retelling the Stories We Believe About Ourselves. And I'm telling you, all of us have some things to reframe in our lives. It's a deep read, I'll tell you that. But you can text the word book if you want in on the drawing. 877-933-2484. Back in a minute. You're listening to a special best of edition of Susie Larson Live. It is well with my soul. just had to let that play out. And thank you so much, the text coming in. Many of us are sappy along with you, Susie. Thank you for that. Appreciate that. You're so wonderful. Talking to Dr. Kurt Thompson. And if you just tuned in, this is one you got to go back and listen to it from the beginning. Once the live show's over, it'll go to podcast. But Dr. Kurt, let's talk a bit about being known and how that really connects to perseverance. I was thinking when I was prepping for the show, there's a part of endurance that's just sort of biding the time, and not everybody who endures is better for it, but the perseverance, as I read in Scripture anyways, is really a necessary part of maturing. So speak to the connection of being known to how we fare when it comes to persevering.
Right. Well, you know, words, as our daughter Rachel, who when she was at Duke Divinity School taught me, Dad, words don't have meaning or definition, they have usage. We use them. And the English translation, the different English translations of Romans 5, for instance, where Paul writes about suffering, perseverance, character, and hope, some translations use the word endurance instead of the word perseverance. And in the English, those words, at least for me, they can connote different things. Endurance, meaning I'm going to like endure this. I'm going to put up with this. I'm going to white knuckle this. Now, others might use that word differently. Perseverance tends to, as I hear that English word, tends to connote a more active, engaged process with whatever it is that's taking place. So much of what the scriptures actually invite us to do is a much more fully and actively engagement with the world around us, even in the process and presence of suffering. And so, though we use the word endurance in terms of, and from that we also get the word durable, right? I can sustain, I can last through this. Part of what we know about the human brain, part of what we know about this notion of being known and that enables us to persevere is that the brain in and of itself can do a lot of really remarkable things. It can do a lot of hard work for a long period of time if it does not have to do it by itself. And that's important. We, when isolated, find that that isolation is the single most powerful drain on a human's capacity to flourish in the world.
Well, say that again. So us being isolated is this a single greatest drain on our capacity to flourish? Is that what you said?
That's right. And I would say from a Christian standpoint, we look back to Genesis chapter 2, where we read God saying, it's not good for man to be alone in this way. It's not good for man to be alone. We also see common everyday examples of this. We know that, social isolation in and of itself, what it's doing in the pandemic. We know that solitary confinement in prison systems only leads to the degradation and deterioration of that particular prisoner's mental state. It doesn't actually help anybody in that regard. We know that those kinds of practices make the brain that much less sustainably able to function in any kind of expected healthy way. However, there was a movie once that some of our listeners might be familiar with. It's called A Beautiful Life. And it's the story, I believe it won the Academy Award for Best Picture of the year that it came out, but it's the story of a Jewish father and his young son in one of the Nazi concentration camps. And it is the story of what it is like for them while they're in the concentration camp. And the story follows this father's creative acts in creating all kinds of games and stories and so forth and so on for his very young son in order to enable his son to survive this awful experience. And this father's work to connect with his son had impact on those around him as well, because, of course, there were those who would look at the father and say, what are you doing? This isn't real. You need to make sure that he can't pretend like this. Based on a true story, this is a movie that demonstrates that when we are connecting with intention in the face of really, really difficult and suffering moments that our brain recognizes that suffering is mostly not about the pain that we are sustaining. Suffering is mostly about our isolation in the face of it.
Mm.
And so to the degree that I am known by another, to the degree that someone comes to me to find out what is my heart feeling like, what is my story about, to the degree that I had that experience of being known by the other, my brain, my mind, my soul becomes deeply aware that I am not alone in the world. And my not being alone means that my shame, my pain, my brokenness is not something I'm carrying by myself. And it is in my not being alone that I now no longer have to burn the energy to contain the negative emotional content that is associated with my traumatic events in my life. If I'm not having to contain and hold on to that in isolation, but it is rather shared, literally the very physical experience of those emotional traumas begins to shift.
Wow.
This is why, again, we say that atonement, the notion of at-one-ment of the crucifixion, is Jesus not just doing something that in the abstract is supposed to save me from sin. All that being true, what's really most important is Jesus coming to me and saying, there's no place where you are where I will not go, where I am not. I am there with you, and it is my being seen by him. And how does that happen? It happens by me being seen by his followers, by us giving others the opportunity to be seen by us, that the gospel message is powerfully, physically delivered. And in so doing, even in the middle of this pandemic, we begin to persevere in a new and fresh way. A couple of the articles, a couple of the essays that I wrote over the course of the early months of the pandemic address a number of very practical steps that people can take. But a number of these steps involve our active willingness to seek out others and to ask you, to call you, to have somebody that I'm calling on a regular basis, and I'm going to say, tell me what was one thing that was really hard for you today, and give it to me like in really concrete, explicit terms. And then tell me something that happened today that you noticed that was an event worthy of your attention and that was an act of beauty. What did you see today that was an act of, what did you see today that brought you joy? Give me some sense of what was hard. Give me some sense of what you feel like you've lost. And give me some sense of what you have seen that has brought you joy. That it's not just that I list these, not just that I can name them. It's that somebody else wants to know this of me. Changes categorically my experience of the very life that I'm in the middle of. This is why this process of being known, as we are known by others and others are known by us, necessarily changes our experience of this difficult time of pandemic.
Wow, there's so much. I'm thinking about what you said, and here we are right to the end of the hour. But, you know, it goes back to that simple gesture of baking cookies or buying a little candle. Man, if there's anything the enemy has wielded is fear, but also isolation. He's had a heyday, but if there's a way we can create and be there and come alongside people, I think there is. We ought to do that. And Dr. Kurt, there's so many good essays on your website, and you've got another great book coming out this year. Please come back and join us again.
I would love to do that, Susie. I'll just look for your invitation.
And that was just a portion of my conversation with Dr. Kurt Thompson. Again, his book is titled The Soul of Shame, Retelling the Stories We Believe About Ourselves. And that's going to do it for this special edition of Susie Larson Live. I'm Susie Larson, and you can find a full-length podcast of all these interviews on our mobile-friendly website at myfaithradio.com. Right now, we're in the midst of our winter fundraiser, and your gift is needed. Financial support of Faith Radio helps shows like Susie Larson Live to continue and to develop new and exciting content. Our podcast and live show are only available to the gifts of listeners just like you. Love it if you could give now at myfaithradio.com or call toll-free at 877-933-2484. And we will meet you back here next time. Thanks for listening to this Susie Larson Live podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. You can become a supporter today at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the show, you can subscribe to the podcast now at Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link to spread the good news of the gospel and to grow the impact of the show. Thanks for listening to Susie Larson Live.